Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. This past Monday, if anyone listening is unaware, KMUN began its 35th year of broadcasting, which is a splendid achievement for a banty, rustic, listener-sponsored public radio station on the faraway upper left coast of the USA. And nearly synchronously, yesterday, April 19th, was KMUN Program Director Elizabeth Mentry's birthday, and also Alexia Lee's proudly 24th natal celebration. Which you might also remember was the famous midnight ride of Paul Revere carrying the torch of revolution to Lexington and Concord on April 19th, 1775. The British were marching into Yankee Doodle Land to quell an incipient rebellion, which by that very act of suppression provoked a full-fledged populist revolution and the birth of a nation. All that seems to have dissipated into legend. Only crinkly documents remain, paramount among them, two that are the guiding principles of our civilization, but which are as often misinterpreted as they are fraudulently maligned, refuted, or disregarded. We are at present becoming uncomfortably aware of what America would be like without liberty, equality, and justice, and are unsure of how to right the imbalance before our democracy as well as our civilization is ripped to shreds upon the iniquitous shrines of ignominy and megalomania. Fortunately, for the sake of liberty, Paul Revere got his signals straight and rode his horse in the right direction that hallowed night 242 years ago, unlike a wrong-way naval armada of very recent history, which calls into question the current trajectory of democracy. Today's program, in salute to the basic principles of democracy, I will read a speech by Philip Stevenson that he gave in 1947 at a symposium on thought control, which paradoxically caused him to be blacklisted during the Joseph McCarthy era of terror. He was one of three scriptwriters for the 1945 movie, The Story of G.I. Joe, which starred Burgess Meredith as the famous World War II war correspondent Ernie Pyle, who was killed by a Japanese sniper on April 18, 1945, the same date in 1906 of the San Francisco earthquake and fire that has often been compared to the Great Astoria Fire of 1922. He was the husband of Janet Stevenson, who died in 2009, and father of Astoria resident and civil rights freedom writer Joseph Stevenson. Back Where We Came From, by Philip Stevenson. As mentioned, Philip Stevenson gave this speech at a symposium on thought control on July 11, 1947. The political events of 1947 have a strangely familiar ring. We've been here before. In fact, we might define the American way of life as an uninterrupted struggle to establish, preserve, and extend basic civil rights, the rights of free expression, assembly, and organization in their own interest against a powerful few who would impair or abolish them. Those of you who attended the opening session of this conference were given a scholarly overall picture of the history of thought control in America. I can assume, therefore, that you understand the function of the smear on name-calling and denunciation in paving the way for the destruction of constitutional rights by legislative and judicial means. You have had a look through the telescope. Now, perhaps it may be useful to examine a small segment of that field under the microscope to analyze one battle of this never-ending war. 3 months ago, when Henry Wallace went overseas to plead the cause of the United Nations and world peace, he was denounced as a traitor to his country, a foreign agent, a tool of the Kremlin. In the American Congress, it was seriously proposed on Wallace's return he be prosecuted under the Logan Law of 1799. What was the Logan Law? The question is interesting. To answer it, we must go back where we came from. Back to the time of the Founding Fathers, specifically back to the fateful year of 1793. In 1793, the Jacobin Society took over control of the French Revolution. The French king and queen were tried for treason, convicted, and executed. Understandably enough, the castles and courts of Europe trembled. This was Les Majestés on the grand scale, and henceforth no crown and no title was safe. To protect their prerogatives, therefore, all the crowned heads of Europe came together in a coalition under the leadership of George III of England to make war on France, to smash the Republic and the Revolution that had established it. What did this European quarrel have to do with America? A good deal, it seems. This summer, Thomas Jefferson wrote in May, is of immense importance to the future condition of mankind all over the earth, and not a little to ours. King George was our traditional enemy. We had fought a revolution to free ourselves from his tyranny. In that revolution, France had been our only, our indispensable ally. In 1793, she was the only other republic on earth, and we were bound to her by a treaty of friendship and mutual aid. So the American people took these events in Europe with great seriousness. Clearly, the majority were grateful to and sympathetic with the French. Crowds wearing Liberty hats surged through the streets of American cities, calling for all-out aid to the French Republic. However, there was a powerful minority that sided with the coalition of kings, the people Hamilton called the rich and well-born, the bankers, speculators, merchants trading on British capital, Tories who had been on the British side during our revolution. Quite frankly, these gentry feared that unless the Jacobin Revolution were crushed in Europe, America might, and I quote, become infected with democracy, quote unquote. The Hamiltonians were well entrenched in the government. Through their Federalist Party, they controlled both houses of Congress and could count on the support of two, sometimes three, out of four members of the cabinet. If America became involved in the European war, it must be on the side of England, they decided. The main obstacle to their plans was, of course, the majority of the people, who were beginning to organize in the Democratic Republican Party. The leader of this party, Thomas Jefferson, had a tremendous popular following. He was the revered author of the Declaration of Independence, which had asserted that whenever any form of government destroyed the inalienable rights of the people and subjected them to despotism, quote, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security, unquote. Jefferson passionately believed that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. Of the French Revolution, he had said in January, the liberty of the whole earth was depending on the issue of the contest. Rather than it should have failed, I would have seen half the earth desolated. To Lafayette, he had written, we are not to expect to be translated from despotism to liberty in a feather bed. In 1793, there could be no question where he stood. As Secretary of State, he could fight Hamilton face to face in the cabinet and perhaps influence the crucial decisions of President Washington. In Congress, he had such able lieutenants as Madison, Monroe, and Gallatin. Philip Freneau, the celebrated poet of the Revolution, edited the National Gazette, a Democratic Republican paper in Philadelphia. Benjamin Franklin Bach, Thomas Adams, Thomas Greenleaf, William Duane fought the People's Cause in other newspapers and countered the war propaganda in the Federalist Press. Through the efforts of such men as these, war with France was barely avoided in 1793. As soon as the crisis was passed, Jefferson resigned from the cabinet. But the minority did not give up its plans. France continued to be treated as a potential enemy, and sympathy for her struggle against the king was denounced as subversive of every American principle. To cut the story short, after 5 years, the Federalists managed to bring on another war crisis. By 1796, George Washington was in retirement. John Adams was president. Jefferson, who had barely missed the presidency by 3 electoral votes, was vice president. The Federalist Party was in the saddle and spurring hard toward open war with France. 1796 was a congressional election year. It was now or never for the Federalists, one of whom, Fisher Ames, candidly declared, "We must make haste to wage war or we shall be lost." to point the crisis, President Adams, at Hamilton's suggestion, declared May 9th a day of national fasting and prayer. But it produced little fasting and no prayer. Warlike speeches thundered in public squares, in college halls, even from fashionable pulpits. And that night, violence broke out. Democratic editor Baca's windows were smashed by a mob, and a statue of Benjamin Franklin in Philadelphia was smeared with mud. This was the signal for a deluge of war propaganda in the Federalist press. Columns were filled with hysterical reports from the usual unimpeachable source, no doubt, that the French had already landed on American soil, were burning and pillaging settlements, murdering babies, and raping women. The Democrats saw no honest reason for war, particularly not war on the side of the European kings against our sister republic, and they vigorously opposed all measures leading to war. As a result, they were denounced as French Jacobins, anarchists, atheists, spies, traitors, and foreign agents. Jefferson, Vice President of the United States, was under surveillance. Snoopers in the post office interfered with his mail so that for 2 years he wrote almost no political letters. Hired musicians played the Rogue's March under his windows at dawn. A Federalist paper replied to the Democratic plea for peace. And yet the word peace re-echoes through our land. Oh shame, oh lasting disgrace. Rivers of blood will not wash it away. The only reply is a blow on the head, a smashed mouth, a kick in the guts. As we now know, no French soldier ever set foot on American shores. Nevertheless, the propaganda worked. Hysterical fear seized the people. Congress was in panic. There were smashed mouths and kicks in the guts on the floor of the House. In a frenzy of haste, bills were passed creating armies, a brand new navy, fortifications, heavy taxes, war loans. It is interesting to note that although the rich and well-born applauded these war measures, their patriotism was not sufficient to induce them to buy war bonds at the legal rate of 6%. They demanded, and Congress promptly gave them, 8%. There were inevitable scandals over defective war materials and profiteering in supplies. When it came to commissioning officers for the new army, Democrats were virtually excluded on the ground that their loyalty was in question, and Federalists demanded the firing of all Jeffersonians among the workers in war plants. Even these measures failed to give the Federalists the security needed for an open declaration of war. The people still resisted. All opposition, therefore, must be suppressed. First, an alien bill was passed that made thousands of immigrants liable to deportation. But the climax came when the Federalists steamrolled through Congress the infamous Sedition Bill. Although war had not been declared, the Sedition Bill specifically named the French people as the enemies of the American people and condemned the sympathy for France as sedition. Still worse, under this law, any criticism of any government official could be construed as criminal libel, punishable by heavy fines and imprisonment. That, mind you, was the moderated form of the bill as finally passed by Congress. In its original draft, it had carried the death penalty. In summing up the Democratic opposition to these bills in the House, Edward Livingston declared, "Like the arch traitor, we cry, Hail Columbia, at the moment we are betraying her to destruction. We sing Happy Land when we are plunging it in ruin and disgrace." James Madison, too, saw clearly what was going on. "Perhaps it is a universal truth," he wrote to Jefferson, "that the loss of liberty at home is to be charged to provisions against danger, real or pretended, from abroad." As for Jefferson, he characterized the Alien and Sedition Acts as a libel on legislation, an experiment on the American mind to see how far it will bear an avowed violation of the Constitution. "The friendless alien," Jefferson declared, "has been selected as the safest subject of a first experiment, but the citizen will soon follow, or rather, has already followed, for already has a Sedition Act marked him as its prey. These laws," he warned, "unless arrested at the threshold, necessarily drive these states into revolution and blood and will furnish new pretexts for those who wish it to be believed that man cannot be governed but by a rod of iron. In other words, the real war was against the American people, against the Republican form of government. The undeclared war on France was a hysterical device to blind the people with patriotic fervor while they were being systematically robbed of their hard-won liberties. Among those who believed in a peaceful settlement with France was Dr. James Logan, a Philadelphia Quaker. Dr. Logan paid his own way to France to study at first hand the sentiment of the people and their leaders toward Americans. Presently, his letters home were stressing the fact that the French did not want war, least of all with their brother Republicans in the United States, and naturally the Democrats did not keep this evidence secret. The Logan letters were a telling blow at the plans of the Federalists. In retaliation, they denounced the gentle Quaker as a traitor, and their partisans in Congress rushed through the Logan Law, making it a felony for a private citizen to meddle in international affairs. Dr. Logan was able to establish that he had in no way meddled, that he had merely asked questions, that he was not prosecuted, merely smeared. So far as I know, no one has ever been prosecuted under the Logan Law, which makes it all the more appalling that after 148 years, it was trotted out as a threat against a former vice president and member of the cabinet. It is significant that only Democrats were prosecuted under the Sedition Act. Against them, the law was enforced with ferocity. U.S. Marshals were instructed to keep Democrats off the juries. In the first 3 months of the act, 21 Democratic editors were jailed and fined for opposing war or criticizing the government. Congressman Matthew Lyon, who edited a paper called The Scourge of Aristocracy, was fined and thrown into a dungeon in spite of the fact that he was an elected representative of the people. Another publisher, Dr. Thomas Cooper, was convicted for criticizing President Adams' warlike measures in time of peace, the new Army and Navy, the 8% war loans, etc. The notorious federal judge, Samuel Chase, solemnly decided that the very existence of the Army and Navy were proof that the Navy was not, that the country was not at peace, that Cooper had therefore published a criminal libel. He fined Cooper $1,000 and sent him to prison for 6 months. In New York, a state senator was convicted for the crime of circulating a petition for the repeal of the Sedition Act. In the same state, a paper editorialized, "When a man is heard to inveigh against the sedition law, set him down as one who deserves to be suspected." Some printers who escaped arrest had their presses smashed, and they themselves were beaten up by soldiers of the new army. Mobs attacked signers of petitions in churchyards. It was the reign of terror. What did the American people do about it? They did what they have always done when their liberties were destroyed. They fought back. They reelected Matthew Lyon to Congress while he was still locked up in jail. And they organized, openly where they could, secretly where they couldn't. They formed a network of Democratic clubs in preparation for the presidential year of 1800, and they never relaxed their pressure against the phony war with France, the new army without an enemy, the 8% loans, war taxes, but especially against the Sedition Act. In 1799, Jefferson could write, "This summer is the season for systematic energies and sacrifices. The engine is the press. Every man must lay his pen and his purse under contribution." New newspapers appeared to take the place of those suppressed. Pamphlets and petitions circulated by the hundreds of thousands. The Federalists had sown the wind of oppression. Now they reaped the whirlwind of depression. There was a sharp financial crisis that sent some of their own leaders to debtors' prison. Even so, they made a half-hearted attempt to turn hard times to good account. A Federalist paper promised that war with France would within 2 months revivify every department of society, commerce would be invigorated, and the funds, government bonds, would rise. But it was already too late. War now was impossible, not only because of depression, but because Napoleon was beating the combined military brains of Europe. The Federalists' only chance was to win the election of 1800 by hook or by crook. They tried both. There has never been a more vicious campaign. Congressman John Allen warned that the election of Jefferson would destroy the Constitution, result in anarchy, wreck the financial system, and bring on civil war. The New England states, he threatened, would secede. The Reverend Cotton Smith accused Jefferson of having acquired his property by robbing a widow and her children of their estate while acting as their executor. But the full flavor of the Federalist campaign comes out in the solemn jeremiads of the Reverend Dr. Timothy Dwight, president of Yale College, better known as the Pope of Federalism. "Why," asked the Reverend Doctor, "should good Americans vote for Jeffersonians? I quote, is that the way we may change our holy worship into a dance of Jacobin frenzy, and that we may behold a strumpet personating a goddess on the altars of Jehovah? Is that what we may see the Bible cast into a bonfire? Is that we may see our wives and daughters the victims of legal prostitution, soberly dishonored, speciously polluted, the outcasts of delicacy and virtue, the loathing of God and man?" And so on for pages. To cut the story short, the people answered the rhetorical questions of Pope Dwight by voting in a landslide for the Democrats. Jefferson, the Jacobin, the anarchist, the atheist, and foreign agent, became president. What did the Federalists get out of their 7 years of effort? They didn't get their war with France. They didn't get a return to monarchical forms. They didn't even secure their own aristocratic rule. At most, they postponed democracy a few years. But in the end, like every clique of the favored few that has tried to suppress the people's rights, they got oblivion. They never won another election. Within a few years, their once powerful party was extinct. That's the lesson of the 1790s, a lesson it is well to remember in 1947. Now, as then, under the threat of war with a radical foreign government, hysteria is being created. Now, as then, all who resist panic, including a former cabinet member and vice president, are branded as radicals, tools, and agents of a foreign power. Now, as then, the people are being subjected to thought control by dubiously constituted un-American committees, by thought police operating under arbitrary executive decree, by legislation like the Taft-Hartley Act. Now, as then, the friendless alien is persecuted for asserting his right to speak, and citizens are prosecuted for such newfangled crimes as conspiracy to commit contempt, whatever that may mean. And finally, now as then, under cover of this patriotic frenzy, the people's pockets are being picked by inflation. Their rights and their standard of living are being systematically destroyed. History does not repeat itself exactly, in spite of the startling parallels it presents to us. The fact that the American people have always fought successfully against all attempts to reduce them to subjection by the favored few is no guarantee they will win again this time. If we look at history in perspective, as we must, we'll find they are in a worse jam today than they were in the 1790s. Then they had a young and vigorous party under inspired leadership to help them fight their cause. The vote on the sedition bill in the House was very close, 44 to 41. Today, well, the vote on the Taft-Hartley bill was 331 to 83. Nevertheless, our task, like that of Jefferson and the Democrats of his time, is to arrest at the threshold these libels on legislation and to organize the fight for a progressive democracy. That's why we are here, and for this task, our inspiration can be our own proud history. And that was Philip Stevenson and a speech he made in 1947, back where we came from. And now, a biography of Philip Stevenson by his son, Joseph Stevenson. My father was born in 1896, the son of a New York lawyer, and grew up on Long Island. Educated in prep schools, he went on to Harvard, then left there after 3 years to enlist in the Navy during World War I, serving first on a ship and eventually behind a desk in Brest, France. When he returned after the war, he worked as a teacher until he was diagnosed with tuberculosis, likely acquired in Europe. He spent 15 years in New Mexico, a lot of it in bed. His writing career began with journalism in the attempt to bring attention to some Southwestern labor struggles he was witness to, but soon moved on to short stories, novels, and plays. In the late 1930s, his disease in remission, he moved back to New York, writing and often working as a publicity agent for theatrical shows in production or on the road. By the time I was born in the fall of 1942, his play, Counterattack, co-authored with my mother Janet, had opened on Broadway. The family moved to Hollywood in 1944. In the film world, he careened from the high of an Oscar nomination for the screenplay of the story of G.I. Joe to the low of becoming unemployable on the Hollywood blacklist for refusing to cooperate with government committees at the height of the McCarthy era. He died in the fall of 1965. In the last weeks of his life, he was hosted and toasted by writers' organizations in several countries, belatedly receiving the kind of recognition that he never got in his own land once he made the choice to speak truth to power. I discovered, back where we came from, a few years ago when going through family papers. It brought back not only the atmosphere of political fear and persecution that characterized my childhood in the heyday of the Cold War, but if you substitute the word terrorism for communism or Jacobin, we see the same scenario all over again today, perhaps worse this time if we take notice that the U.S. Congress has recently endorsed torture and tossed aside habeas corpus. My father looked back at the 1790s for historical precedent. We don't have to look that far to see that civil liberty and democracy are threatened as much by flag-waving patriots as by sword-wielding invaders. It is worth pointing out that this essay, originally delivered as a speech to a symposium on thought control on July 11, 1947, may have contributed to my father being subpoenaed to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee and his subsequent blacklisting. Acts like these were not easy on the families of those who stuck their necks out. Speaking for myself, I applaud and honor what he did and have tried to follow in his footsteps when the opportunity has presented itself. I recommend the same path to those who truly treasure liberty and believe in democracy. And that was Joseph Stevenson writing about his father, Philip Stevenson. Joseph lives in Astoria. He is a musician, writer, and stage producer, and is a former program director for KMUN. He wrote, produced, and directed Woody Guthrie for the stage in the 1990s, and in 1964 was a civil rights freedom writer jailed in Texas. He is also a registered nurse specializing in hospice home care. Joseph's mother, Janet Stevenson, who died June 9, 2009, at 96, was one of the last mayors of Hammond and a member of the Clatsop County Home Charter Committee, among many other community and political activities. She was author of several novels, including Departure and The Slope, which was published just before her death, and she wrote articles about women's history for American Heritage magazine. A book she wrote, The Last Town in Oregon, was published posthumously at her request. And this has been Michael McCusker, reminding you that Saturday, April 22nd is Earth Day 47, and that every day is Earth Day. Be an environmental vigilante. UPS toxic waste to the White House every day. Slather Trump Tower in malodorous sludge and righteous bile. And yes, plow up and replant every golf course in the USA for community farms and vegetable gardens, starting with Trump's Dixie White House with the kiddies' toy name, Mar-a-Lago, and renovate those Palm Beach luxury suites into low-cost housing for the low-income and homeless. Happy Earth Day.